This is Scott Fratcher, and I'm at the studios of Radio for Peace International. And with me today is James Latham, the station manager and one of the founders of Radio for Peace International. We're going to be talking today about the crisis that's happening at Radio for Peace International, the lockout by the University for Peace, also on the same UN-donated grounds. And we're going to be talking about the reasons for the lockout, what are the possible motivations of the University for Peace and their actions, their, I guess, what you would call non-peaceful actions. And we're going to be talking to James about the history of the station and how you, the listener, supported this station over the years and what our roles are today. So, James, welcome to the studio.
Thank you.
James, I'd like to start with the buildings themselves. The buildings with themselves, who owns and who built these buildings?
These buildings were constructed over a period of years and finished about 1991, I believe it was. Probably the second floor was perhaps around 1995 we completed that. All of the buildings were constructed by listeners' donations. Over a period of time, everybody, including the staff, I want to mention this, chipped in on these buildings. And the staff did this in a way that they took a stipend from their wages, for their wages, I should say, instead of a full salary. And so they were working for $200, $300, $400 a month, in order for the station to construct the buildings. Everybody agreed in the staff one time that we would take a pay cut so that we can get these buildings up and in use, and then go back to a fair wage in this area. The donations came in from listeners, from very poor listeners that didn't have a lot of funds. They wanted to support the cause of having an independent voice, a left populist progressive voice on the airways. And it also came in from people who had means and had some cash to donate. I can give you some examples of different people that supported it. I know one is from a fellow who was retired here in Costa Rica. His name was Joe O'Buckley, and Joe just had a few years, and he was really aware of his condition, and he wanted to make a significant difference in the world. And he had tuned into RFPI, became a listener and supporter, and he called us up, and he donated the last remaining amount of money that he had to the construction of Radio for Peace International, the buildings, the transmitting room, and the facilities. And this was not untypical. I mean, people over the years really got behind the project and supported it, the people that listened to it.
Those are some dedicated listeners and dedicated staff.
Yes. And I, you know, we knew that for the office and studios and everything else, we needed to have a facility to house the kind of equipment and the growth that we were experiencing during the 90s, and especially during the mid 90s. And so we managed to build a large two-story building here by permission and understanding of the University for Peace, who understood that these buildings would be used exclusively for RFPI to perform their tasks of bringing the world these messages of peace and understanding and conflict resolution.
And you say with the permission and understanding of University for Peace, did you get anything in writing at the time when you started the building?
Oh, yes, of course. We did. We were not going to, you know, embark on such an investment as this involving hundreds of thousands of dollars and not do that. We did. We had some a document in writing that we had permission to build this and exclusive rights to use it for our project.
And how much of the building was built by the University of Peace? What did they donate to the project?
They didn't donate any. The radio station was always separately funded. In the construction of the building, there was no funding on behalf of the University for Peace. It was totally from listeners and from staff, as I indicated. The funds came exclusively from there. Later on, in 2000, the University for Peace did donate a LAN system, a local area network system, to the radio station.
But it wasn't an internet system.
Yes, and for hooking up to high-speed internet. It was it wasn't a donation, however. In entirety, it was offered to us. We had to pay. The whole university compound was given a high-speed internet connection, and they asked us to pay for it. But knowing that RFPI wasn't in the, didn't have the ability at that time to pay for the $14,000 system, we were asked to pay in kind or in amounts that would be mutually agreeable and a mutually agreeable timetable.
And what would pay in kind mean?
Well, in the past we had done radio documentaries about the University for Peace. We had done video documentaries. I mean, we didn't do the video part. We did the narration part and helped with the language that was used. And so we cooperated with several projects that the University for Peace were involved with, including coverage of various events and activities that the United Nations, that the University for Peace was involved with. And so we were always doing promotional work for the University for Peace, even to the point of assisting them on a consultative basis regarding documents that they were sending out, regarding even the expansion, additions up there at the University for Peace. At one point in time, the University for Peace had been hit by lightning and numerous of their computers were affected. And they noted that none of our computers had been affected during this lightning strike. So they asked us, how do you protect your system, your internet system? And we showed them how to protect that through lightning discharge units that could be installed in all their computer network. So we were often doing consultative work for the University for Peace in helping them. So that would be how we can, we would have.
I see. So that would be a quid pro quo kind of.
Yes.
You help us, we help you. A very friendly relationship, you might say.
We've had many years of very friendly relationship, five administrations that the radio station has worked with in that type of friendly way.
And so this is the sixth administration.
Yes, it is.
And when did this administration start?
It came in around the end of 1999 and really was in place by 2000.
Who's the director of the current administration?
Well, it's kind of difficult to say. If you look at the top of the ladder of the chain of command at the University for Peace, it would be Maurice Strong.
And how do you spell Maurice Strong?
M-A-U-R-I-C-E-S-T-R-O-N-G.
Okay, and just as a note, I would suggest anybody that's listening that has access to the internet to do an internet search of Maurice Strong and look for your reactions and see what the world is saying and the articles that are out there and do a little bit of research on that.
Yes, I've been told there's quite a number of page postings, something like 300,000, and some positive and some not so positive websites and postings.
And another question, was Maurice Strong, was he a university professor or something of that nature to get this position?
No. He's a businessman. I think he was involved with an oil company in Canada for many years, Petro-Canada. He's a multi-billionaire businessman.
To be clear, he is now the top man at the University for Peace, but he doesn't have a university background, so to speak.
No. He sits on the Well, we'd call it a board of directors. It's the Council of the University for Peace, and he sits as the president of that council.
Now, doing a little bit of internet research, I found that the council should, if I understand this correctly, be voting on something like the position that the University for Peace has taken on Radio for Peace International. And have you been contacted by any of the council members or attempted to contact any of the council members?
We have been told that the council had some discussion. We've been told by several functionaries of the University for Peace that this was a council decision. And basically, they said, this is out of our hands. We are not going to make any decisions about the radio station. It has to be the council that decides. The thing is, I'm not sure if the council has been properly informed of some very important facts. That being that the project here was independently funded, that Radio for Peace built the facilities that we operate out of, that that we've had a long-standing relationship with the University for Peace as being independent from them, as journalists should be. It's not uncommon for radio stations that are connected with universities to be independent so that their journalist skills can be practiced in total independence and freedom of expression. So that's a pretty common practice. I don't think that the council was informed of any of this, and I think that this has been a... they certainly have not contacted us. And welcome to do so. We hope
wait a minute. Let me just clarify that. This is a decision that's being made about Radio for Peace by, presumably, the council members of the University for Peace. Mm-hmm. And a decision of this nature was taken, and you weren't contacted to come up and present your side of the story, to negotiate, to talk, to anything?
No, we were not. In fact, at one particular council meeting that we were allowed to go to, even at this time, I guess the writing was on the wall, so to speak, as they say. We were in attendance to one of the council meetings, as many other observers were. They had probably 60 or 70 observers, and then the council members themselves. And as Marie Strong was ticking down the agenda items and got to Radio for Peace International, he took it out of the agenda list and said to the members present that this particular agenda item he will handle personally, and it was never discussed at that particular meeting in an open forum.
That doesn't quite sound correct, I should say.
Well, I don't know if the council is supposed to be democratic in any way. I don't know what. I would think that morally they would have a responsibility to ask for clarification on issues such as this.
And how long has the council themselves been? Is this council part of the current administration?
It was selected by Maurice Strong.
I see. So the current council came with the current administration.
I think a good number. There may have been some rollovers from the past councils, but I think that a good number of the new council were personally selected by Maurice Strong.
Well, if that's the case, then how much of the professorship and existing staff and such, how much of that existing staff is from the previous administrations?
Not very much. There was a considerable amount of firing, I think, over the years, a purging that some people called it, of people.
Now, this is the sixth administration. Mm-hmm. So when the fourth administration, let's say, moved and became the fifth administration, mm-hmm. was there a purging at that point?
No. It was between the fifth and sixth administration that the purging
started. And the third to the fourth administration, was there a purging?
No.
Were there any previous purges?
No, none that I know of. I mean, there were some layoffs because of the staff shrinking. you know, simple budgetary layoffs where people were laid off because the budget was cut. And there was that was, you know, so the, it did shrink down in that respect.
And this current purging, did that seem to be along ideological lines?
I think perhaps it was, and looking at it, I'm not really sure. But it wasn't over a budgetary cut. It wasn't due to funding. It was certainly not in that arena like it had been in the past. It was much more of a an issue of the individuals who had worked here for a long time and them wanting to eliminate them from the roles of the University for Peace faculty.
And that faculty, were they given golden parachutes and left to retire? And
no. Sadly, you hear about some diplomats and career people at the United Nations that do get a pretty reasonable, I think, severance pay and retirement package. None of that happened, as far as I can tell, from none of the individuals that were laid off. Some of them haven't gotten any severance pay and are pretty bitter about that, having worked at the university for 5, 6, 7, 8 years or more in some cases. I think they have been really been bittered by the whole experience.
So just to be clear, then, in about 1999 to 2000, there was a change of I guess you would say, ideological views at the University for Peace, and the council changed, the staff changed, and the head man changed.
Yes.
And at that point, your relationship with the University for Peace changed to deteriorating to the present state.
Yes, and we should mention the present state is this current lock-in, I guess you would call it, where we've been handed a notice of request to remove ourselves and our equipment from the facility. We've been given that until August 4th, and now it's been extended on behalf of the University for Peace to August 11th. So,
and so your gates are locked.
Yes, yes, they are. And an armed guard has been posted, sometimes armed and sometimes not, I guess, outside the door of the radio station.
And so with the gates locked, and yet you've also been given a letter from a lawyer to vacate your building. Did they state any way of how you would be expected to remove your equipment through locked
this
gates?
This is kind of the illogical moves that they've been making here of late, which makes me very concerned about exactly who is doing this. I mean, is this a small functionary at the University for Peace that are making these decisions, or is it somebody up above? If it was somebody up above, you'd think they would have enough sense to not lock up a facility that you have to either and ask to be removed from that area. That's not logical. Also, I want to point out that it's very upsetting to have armed guards at the radio station, or at, for that matter, at the University for Peace. The radio station has had a policy that we established many years that nobody on the premises here would have a weapon, would have a gun. Considering the nature of our activities, our goals, our philosophy at the radio station, we did not believe in the need for such weapons, that there was any justifiable reason for carrying a loaded weapon on the grounds here. And now there is these guards carrying weapons just outside the door within a matter of 10 meters away from where we sit here doing this interview. And that's very disturbing. It's disturbing for the employees at the radio station, the volunteers and students that we have coming down to the station. This is, to us, not acceptable to have any individuals here. This is also, we believe, a form of of intimidation. And, you know, sadly, it is a reflection on the bigger problem in the world as it is. The reason countries go at war is because they end up with some armies, people armed on the borders, you might say right outside their doors of their country. And this is why we have armed conflicts, clashes between countries in the world today. This mode of thinking, this is old thought, I guess you would call it. This is not a new paradigm or a new concept in the world today, where we say we can peacefully get along, we can work together. As an example, Robert Mueller's talks about a unified Europe where you no longer have to have armed guards posted at border crossings. You know, you can easily go from one country to another in freedom without somebody stopping you and imposing this threatening stance. This is highly regressive. I mean, the thinking behind this should have died out a long time ago. As the dinosaurs died out, this kind of thinking we have to get beyond and put aside. And I don't think there is time and room in space for us to be going back to those kind of times, going back to, patrolling our borders with people who are armed. And I think that it's very interesting to see the symbology of a chain locked across our gates that we built here at RFPI, we might add, or an armed guard posted at our front door. This is the kind of thing that has caused countries to go to war in the past. And this is not what peace groups should be about. We want to make another statement that Radio for Peace, this is not what we're about. We reject this kind of activity. We reject this kind of thinking and philosophy. Why does the University for Peace need to have an armed guard in the first place? Are we worried that somebody is going to break into the University for Peace and steal peace from it? Are we concerned about that? And let me point out one other thing. Some years ago, a French philosopher and writer came to the University for Peace and was quite a remarkable man, well known, and I wish I had written down his name, but had quite an entourage of people. And I happened to be wandering the hallways of the University for Peace and spotted him with about a dozen dignitaries. And he was looking around, and he was looking at, there's a gift shop up at the University for Peace, and he looked into the gift shop window, and he noted that the door was locked on the gift shop. And I could see certain sadness across his face. He said to the officials at the University for Peace, "I would like to purchase something from this gift shop." And immediately they ran to get the keys to unlock the door to the gift shop. And he walked into the gift shop and he roamed around and looked at the various books and T-shirts and items on sale. There was numerous things there, paraphernalia with a University for Peace logo on them. And I noted kind of interestedly, I was sitting outside the gift shop and kind of taking this all in. And I noted this person's sadness in a way as he was roaming around. And finally, he put his hands behind his back and kind of strolled out of the gift shop. And there was a people from the University for Peace still there waiting patiently for him. And he said, "I've made my decision." And with a very clear and direct approach, he said, "I wish to buy that lock off of the door of the gift shop, and I will write you a check for whatever amount it cost." There was some discussion amongst the University for Peace officials, And they sold them the lock, I think for a considerable amount of money as a donation. I wish I had known this marvelous French intellectual and writer, because I think he was spot on. I do not think that the University for Peace should be behind locked gates. I do not think that there should be armed guards at the University for Peace. I do not think that there should be a fence built around the University for Peace. I think the University for Peace should be a institution open to all peoples, to come freely, without any hindrance, without any conditions. I think that this is an institution that should be for all people and not for a select group of people.
Well, presumably, previous administrations also had armed guards and gates.
No, they did not.
So the arming of the guards is a...
Recent administration. The other administrations did have, quote, guards. These were the people responsible for... I have to say what they really were responsible for is occasionally a stray cow or a horse would get into the premise of the University for Peace, and largely their responsibility was to kind of shoo the cow or the horse out of the premises so that they wouldn't, they wouldn't leave their cow pies behind in the hallways. And this was what they were there for. They would be there and keep kind of I won't say even a close eye on the University for Peace, because Costa Ricans would come through and wander through the University for Peace, look through the marvelous hallways at the various statues and the posters and the exhibits of peace that they would have around the hallways. It was a marvelous place that was open to all. And there was no restricting of that. And I think that having just some people casually around that would occasionally shoo out the stray horse or close the gates at night so that the horses and cattle and stuff in this area, because the University for Peace for the people is located in a rural setting, a countryside setting, where there is critters like horses and cows and things roaming around out there. And I think that was a marvelous idea, as the concept was. And by the way, there really wasn't any serious problems with vandalism. Certainly nothing that would warrant the use of weapons.
So there wasn't a particular incident that took place that changed the policy of the University for Peace. This was an ideological change that came in with the current administration.
Yes. There was no armed robbery or anything like this at the University for Peace. There was talk when this administration came in of putting a large cyclone fence around the University for Peace, a protective fence that would guard it. And I think that was somewhat laughed at the time. Now, we may see that happen in the future. It was considered an appearance that would give the University for Peace sort of a Stalag or a Gulag appearance with armed guards roaming around, and not quite the image that I think the University for Peace deserves.
Well, we would expect the University of Peace then to be at the forefront of conflict resolution and teaching the ways of nonviolent changing the world.
Yes. Well, there is indeed a lot of conflict resolution that is going on by invited academics that come to the University for Peace to present conflict resolution. There is... Some, I think, of the top people in conflict resolution that do come and give those lectures on conflict resolution and peaceful negotiation. But that is not, unfortunately, what they seem to have been applying in the particular present crisis where they have virtually tried to shut down the radio station.
Perhaps those professors should come in a consultative...
Well, we certainly would invite that kind of activity, yes.
Well, let's move on then. This radio station, Radio for Peace International, we typically call a progressive radio station.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess if you were to say other radio broadcasting entities out there, oftentimes people would also think of the Pacifica Network as a progressive station.
Sure.
And on the as we're broadcasting on shortwave, are there any other shortwave progressive stations?
No, I think there is not. There is, you know, in terms of there are some very reactive stations out there, reactionary stations that broadcast organized hate groups, Klan members, militia groups, and the like. We did a lot of research on these and written many articles for the Southern Poverty Law Center, a couple articles for them. And there is that element of stations that are operating out there that have a total different slant on a view of the planet and the direction that we as the people in the planet should take. This is one of racism. It's one of eliminating the UN and things of this nature.
This is other stations on mm-hmm. shortwave bands.
Yes, yes. Stations licensed in the United States. You don't see that in other countries, by the way. That is just something that is a phenomenon that has occurred in the United States on U.S. private stations, WWCR, WBCQ, WWFV, and others. Who attract a segment of right-wing populism to their airways. And this is the mentality of build a fence around us, protect the, you know, the race, protect our sovereignty of our little soil here that we are. Don't let any foreigners in. Don't do this. It's very regressive. In nature, the philosophy, sort of a survivalist type of mentality. Let me point out that in terms of using that term survivalist, we're all survivalists since the time of conception. the idea is to survive and things, but some survivalists tend to want to put up a wall around themselves and survive within this little cage that they make. Many of us look upon that as not really survival. We look upon that as fencing ourselves in, cutting off a great cultural experience with other peoples. And the true survival of the planet and the species won't be from that kind of thinking. That's putting your head in the sand and just wishing it'll all go away. We need to survive on this planet in harmony with the environment and making the planet a better place for future generations. And that doesn't mean that we should be able to buy, you know, more and more and consume more and more, because the planet cannot, certainly not handle that. So the dinosaurs that we have today, based on a model of sort of a pyramid scheme of consumption of more and more and more goods, cannot survive. I think the real survivalist, the real survivalism for the species, for the planet, is based in cooperation, of understanding with one another on the planet, of getting along in a peaceful coexistence, and understanding that not everybody is going to agree with everybody else. I mean, it is that we have to have respect for people who have different opinions, and we have to have mechanisms in place so that people have different beliefs in what they believe as God, what they believe in terms of a economic system, and yet still survive and still function along the side of each other, and each have rights that they're entitled to. Those rights have been pretty clearly written in the UN Declaration of Human Rights.
Well, then, can you describe or define, then, what a progressive voice would be?
Well, in terms of a progressive, there probably is no real in-stone description of that. Sometimes you can say it's the absence of these certain qualities. It's certainly a progressive would not be a racist. A progressive would not have just nationalistic tendencies. They would have sort of worldwide tendencies, knowing that if we have a toxic plant in our country and it's next to another, that it affects those other countries and other people. So we have to go beyond these little national boundaries that we are and think in terms of the whole world. What we do on one part of the world will affect people in another part. So I think progressives tend to think more globally than they do just locally. But their whole view encompasses everything from the local environment, the local people, the relationship with those people and the environment, to the global perspective and the relationship to other peoples around the planet, as well as the worldwide environment. I think they tend to be optimistic and idealistic in terms of their belief system. They often are at odds against multinational corporations, which the progressive will see as being an unchecked force in the world. They're not necessarily calling for the elimination of multinational corporations or corporations as a whole, just that those corporations act in a responsible way and are accountable to people rather than accountable to themselves, that there is some restraints, conditions, rules that those multinational corporations have to abide. As an example, an automobile manufacturer may jump into Mexico and start building autos there because it is inexpensive to do so. And there's no unions. Well, unions have a right to exist in Mexico or any country in the world and to work for the betterment of the people in that area. What exists for a multinational corporation, the ability to move from one country to another, should exist for people as well, who should be able to move freely from one country to another, or who should be able to unionize in one country or the other freely. These are sort of standards, I think, that progressives will have. The idea that we need to protect everything, every living thing on the planet is an important thing. And a look at the effects of what we do today on future generations. And the ability to give all people a voice in the world, that all people have rights and certain privileges, the privilege of living a happy life, a healthy life, of being taken care of the ability to choose, you know, what religion or what political system they want to incorporate. I think that a lot of these things are what encompasses the idea and the thought and the philosophy of progressives.
Okay, well then, if we carry on with that thought, then the progressive voice is a voice of public opinion. And that public opinion has, I guess, what you would call a very small slice, the progressive voice in radio and broadcast TV and and the radio waves in general.
It has been, I think, purposely marginalized, attacked, and rooted out. I don't know a better word for it. And I can only say from my own experience, I haven't lived and grown up in South Africa or Belgium or some other country around the world. And so I can only, you know, view it from my own experience living here in the Americas. But I can say in traveling in many countries, it seems like there's a similar activity going on against the progressive voices. What we see today in laws being written from the U.S. to the rest of the world is not the inclusion of other voices and opinions on the airwaves, but the exclusion of those voices, the elimination of the progressives, specifically targeting of those. Now, when I say that, I would like to kind of qualify why I'm of this opinion, because it's obvious that this will be very disagreeable with the corporate-controlled media. They wouldn't agree with this. Or it is the people of the right-wing populist would definitely not agree with this. In fact, they would state that the liberal progressives control all the media. And I think that's a sad misinformation that they've been fed by corporate-controlled media. We're not – if the progressives were in control of media – today, I think you would see a substantially different media on the planet. Radio for Peace International wouldn't be a lone voice out there. So what we see is – I'll give you an example. A station such as Steve Anderson, who set up his own little transmitting station in Tennessee. This was a former Klansman, militia individual – dedicated to shooting anybody that was in disagreement with him or calling for that, a Christian identity follower, operated for 8 months a station in Somerset, Tennessee. At the same time that he was operating that station, which was unlicensed, a station out in Portland, Oregon called KBOO, that's its call letters, KBOO, was fined for having a feminist song on, $7,000 fine, I believe it was. And this was an FCC, a Federal Communications Commission action, to go after the, again, progressive voice, and to ignore the right-wing populist or racist, in this case, outwardly racist voice of Steve Anderson. He was never, his radio station was never closed down. He got into a shootout with a officer, a law officer, and his station was never shut down by the Federal Communications Commission.
And that was an unlicensed station. That was
unlicensed,
a pirate broadcast,
and
so to speak.
Yes. And it was a station that called for violence against individuals and groups. So I say that there is a prejudice. There is a in the works against us. We have such a small foothold in terms of the progressive voice around the world, such a small, dedicated, yes, but in numbers and in terms of sheer size, there is no community station in Costa Rica other than Radio for Peace International. They are internet casts that have come from here. There has been attempts for community radio here, but it doesn't exist. And the likelihood of community radio growing in numbers and existing in larger quantities is very much diminishing as time goes on. Certainly it is that case in the United States, where community radio is, new community stations are probably going to pop up on the internet, but not over the airwaves. And this has virtually eliminated the voice of many, many people, marginalized, and skewered the airwaves towards a corporate agenda.
And you mentioned the internet. I should mention that Sonoma State's Project Censored has the Internet 2 coming out to replace Internet 1, and that's, of course, going to make major changes in the internet. And that, last I saw, was progressing quite rapidly. And so, yeah. Another thing on there, on that internet broadcast, and because we hear this quite often, we hear people say, "Well, you know, it doesn't really matter what happens to the airwaves. You know, you've got all the freedom that you want on the internet." Whereas a inexpensive shortwave receiver might be $15, $20 that mm-hmm. anybody can buy and anybody can carry with them while they're bicycle riding or sure. jogging. And the internet, which is predicted to soon be under attack, costs...
Wait a minute. I would like to point out something. Not going to be. It is under attack.
Or is under attack, yes. It is under attack.
It started to be under attack when the commercial interests said, what a great medium this is, and started to crowd out. I remember I've used the internet from the earliest days of its existence. I'm not going to be an Al Gore and say I invented it. I didn't. But I used it since its early conception, when there was just a few organizations, and they were educational organizations, you know, communicating back and forth, swapping information largely. They were databases that were, you know, at your disposal to enter into and everything else. Now, if you try to find those kind of resources on the internet, you have to go through a lot of commercial propaganda before you ever enter into that kind of stuff, it seems like. Go to the search engine, find out how many little propaganda things pop up and such before you can find a site that has just some hard scientific evidence that you've been looking for. So already we are being bombarded by commercial interests. And may I point out that that parallels something that occurred many years before, and that was with the birth of radio in the United States, probably paralleled in other countries as well, where the early pioneers of radio, the Armstrongs and DeForests and others, Fresdens, who said, this is a marvelous intellectual, cultural medium where we can experience incredible lectures, talks, plays, music, and what a grand thing this is. And so they started in broadcasting these items. Armstrong in New York City did not go on the air and broadcast commercials for soap when he first invented his FM transmitter and started to transmit FM signals for the first time. The idea was to broadcast plays, intellectual activities of the people in the city of New York. And so what happened was a kind of I guess you would say bastardization of the radio occurred, where these people gave this marvelous, exciting material free, and then it was commercialized. And the commercial interests saw vast dollar signs in the possibilities what radio could be, and started to broadcast the huge amounts of commercials to go along with this medium. And by the way, it should be pointed out that who paid for that was not the corporations, but in turn, the consumers of products who went out and bought that box of cereal and no longer was paying what the cereal was really costing to produce by the manufacturer, plus a reasonable percentage of profit, but all of a sudden they were paying for the advertising dollars on that cereal. So now when you buy a box of cereal and it costs you $3 or something, and you're thinking about that box of cereal, you basically buy, you can go out and buy in the markets or the stock market, that kind of product, whatever it is, corn or wheat or whatever, for a mere $3 for a ton, you're realizing, well, the cardboard box costs something. And yeah, those people working in that factory, I know I worked in these kind of factories, they get their wages on there too. And then there has to be a healthy profit, even if it's 50%. Still, that cereal doesn't cost that much. And there's a reason why it is inflated so much. And that is because of the commercialization, the cost of running commercials in every medium that there is now, including the internet. And now we see the internet going the same line. For those proponents of the internet, yes, it's a marvelous medium. It's great. You can get emails sent back and forth. You can always keep in touch with your family. All this stuff is just fabulous. But we are really starting to lose the internet as a people's initiative. And that's what it really really started out. I mean, yes, it was started out as a government intelligence system for communicating between universities and military and all this other stuff, then opened up and allowed other users in there. And there was this takeoff period where everybody just got into the internet and said, this is marvelous, you know, we could set up this and this and this and this. And then it became highly commercialized and will do so to the point where it'll be bogged down, my belief is, with so much commercialization that you will have to, just like you do on television today, you will have to weed through hours and hours and hours of commercial propaganda to get to the root of what you really need to know. And you may not even find it then.
Can you talk about how this current crisis at Radio for Peace International has changed what your focus, your daily focus, instead of, let's say, radio production and the content of your shows, mm-hmm. and what are you doing now daily compared to what you would normally be doing?
Well, today we are having to focus on just the survival of the station, and I think that if nothing else, we need to use each of these cases, be it the Pacifica Radio, the hostile takeover of Pacifica Radio a few years ago, where the progressive forces once again gained control. We have to use these as examples of what to do and how to defend ourselves. So in a sense, we're also documenting what we're doing here, our activities, how well our not so well, we're defending the station for the people. We have become, in a sense, a defense mechanism for the listeners and for the progressive community to defend this outlet. Again, there's so few. There's not many. The percentage of progressive voices out there are infinitesimally small. And it's quite amazing to me sometimes that really the forces, the corporate forces in the world, would even spend the time and effort, considering how small we are. But apparently it's important to have total control. You know, in just going through 1984, George Orwell's book, we see a scenario world where there is no dissent, where there is nothing. It's squinched. It's silenced before there's ever a possibility of dissent, of getting together more than one or two people. There is no ability in the world of 1984 for a dissenting voice. And I can't help but think that this is the direction. This is almost like a game plan, a working a business plan for the people in the world today to get to, is to do absolute social control and conditioning of the people so that they have no ability to be independently thinking, of questioning authority, of asking the serious questions, one, because they don't have the information to even do that. And so we're, you know, sadly moving in the world today in that direction, I feel. I personally think that it's important to always have opposing viewpoints, of to having some sort of an opposition out there, some sort of questioning, you know, a consciousness that just sort of echoes back. Are you really doing the right thing, or is this going to hurt the environment? Are you really doing the right thing? Is this really a benefit to the people? And RFPI has been that small voice, I think, speaking those and asking those questions. Without that, we have a corporate monolith that is rolling along with no consciousness.
Thank you, James. And do you have any last things that you'd like to close with?
Well, regardless what happens in this situation, I think we as progressives have to continue on. We have to focus on media. It is essential to get the progressive voices out there, to have that foothold. We must not lose this struggle in terms of media. Each generation, it becomes more difficult. There were people in the 30s and 40s trying and struggling to win the cause of educational radio. There were people later in the 50s trying to win the cause of educational television. I have to say, by and large, they lost. Each generation coming along is going to be finding it more difficult to fight against a system that is misguided, that is harming the planet and people on the planet. We must not lose this struggle. We must try for the generations to come that will be involved in these struggles to provide a spot on the dial, a channel on the television, a place on the satellite, area, a website on the internet, so that our voices are heard. We have to focus our energy that this is of utmost importance. For all too long, we as progressives have relied that, oh, mainstream media will pick up our case. They will understand the logic of it, the intelligence of it. They will understand that destroying the environment is not a good thing. We have relied on that logic for the corporate giants in media to understand that logic and care. But it isn't necessarily the case. I think that that's misguided. I think that it's been proven incorrect. And I think that corporate media giants are only looking at next quarter's earnings and not if the planet is still going to be around in a healthy way for future generations. I think what we have to look at is a major rethinking of our strategy, and think that we have to create our own radio stations. We have to create our own institutions to teach radio, to teach media, And to get the next generations coming up involved in that and get them trained and get them out there and look at acquiring spots on the radio dial, TV channels, to really get involved and get behind this. Because if we are going to cut out our tongues, it's going to be very hard to explain to the rest of the world what we feel and what we think. And we must focus our energies on this. This is an ongoing struggle. It has been going on for many years and will continue to go on. And we must be able to hand over to the next generations and make it a little easier for them. And at the present, we're failing pretty bad, I think, in that. And I think that has to be a prime focus for us in these next this next decade. Thank you.
And James, thank you for your time. And this is Scott Fratcher at the studios of Radio for Peace International, covering the crisis at Radio for Peace International.